You're listening to Expanding Horizons, the podcast of the Unitarian Church of South Australia, a home of progressive spirituality and free religious thought and action since 1854. The views expressed in these podcasts are those of the speaker and are not intended to represent the position of the church itself or of the worldwide Unitarian Universalist movement. For more information, visit unitariansa.org.au.
Are any of you doing philosophy at school? No? You've probably... Well, you've all probably heard of psychology, but probably not a lot about philosophy. And it's actually quite lined up with Unitarian values to me. And a broad description of philosophy is the love and the application of wisdom. Love of the universe, love for humanity, love for one's country, love for the family, and most of all, love for oneself. I've got a, because you're not used to baby stories anymore, you're too old, got a couple of little short stories for you today. So the first story happened in Lahore, India. In a co-educational school, a girl lost her pen and she complained to the teacher by accusing a boy pupil. When the boy was accused, he asked the teacher to let him know the price of the pen so he could pay tomorrow. Next day he paid, and the topic came to a close. Oh, very pretty. Since young people are not too clever in such matters, except you all, of course, the real culprit brought the pen in his box, which was seen by the girl. She went to the teacher and said that the pen was taken by one and the punishment paid by another. This injustice ought to be corrected. After a search, the pen was found. The perplexed teacher then asked the first boy why he paid for the pen when he had not stolen it. The boy had very disciplined parentage. He said, "If I had protested my innocence, who would have listened to me? And this would have pained me. So it seemed to me that peace of mind was more valuable than 5 rupees, and I paid the money to save my peace." The teacher was astonished at this answer, worthy of only a great man. This established an ideal, and all paid their respects to the boy. That's by Shantananda Saraswati. Another little one. Keep in mind the next time you're about to repeat a rumour or spread gossip. In ancient Greece, about 400 years before Christ was born, Socrates was widely lauded for his wisdom. One day, an acquaintance ran up to him excitedly and said, "Socrates, do you know what I just heard about Diogenes?" "Wait a moment," Socrates replied. "Before you tell me, I'd like you to pass a little test. It's called the triple filter test." "Triple filter?" asked the acquaintance. "That's right," Socrates continued. "Before you talk to me about Diogenes, let's take a moment to filter what you're going to say. The first filter is truth. Have you made absolutely sure that what you are about to tell me is true?" "No," the man said. "Actually, I just heard about it." "All right," said Socrates. "So you don't really know if it's true or not. Now let's try the second filter, the filter of goodness. Is what you are about to tell me about Diogenes something good?" "No, on the contrary." "So," Socrates continued, "you want to tell me something about Diogenes that may be bad, even though you're not certain it's true." The man shrugged, a little embarrassed. Socrates continued, "You may still pass the test, though, because there is a third filter, the filter of usefulness. Is what you want to tell me about Diogenes going to be useful to me?" "No, not really." "Well," concluded Socrates, If what you want to tell me is neither true nor good or even useful, why tell it to me or anyone at all? The man was bewildered and ashamed. This is an example of why Socrates was a great philosopher and held in such high esteem.
And they're going to be reflecting on their experience at the Shady Grove camp, which is, it's wonderful that three times a year they're still going and having a wonderful camp up at the Shady Grove site that we have near Littlehampton.
The imagination places that the world of the future, either above us or far below, are in a relation of metempsychosis to ourselves. We dream of travelling through the universe, but is not the universe within ourselves? The depths of our spirit are unknown to us. The mysterious way leads inwards. Eternity with its worlds, the past and the future, is in ourselves or nowhere. The external world is the world of shadows. It throws its shadow into the realm of light. At present, this realm certainly seems to us so dark inside, lonely, shapeless. But how entirely different it will seem to us when this gloom is past and the body of shadows has moved away. We will then experience great enjoyment, for our spirit has been deprived.
Now, who was this character Novalis? Georg Philipp Friedrich Freiherr von Hardenberg. You can understand why he shortened it to Novalis. This scientist, poet, and mystic was in awe of the universe, and he sublimely expressed its beauty and majesty. He epitomized the Romantic movement, which flourished in Germany and other parts of Europe in the early period of what we call the Enlightenment. Yes, it was the beginning of the Age of Reason, although if you look around the world today, you might think that some people missed the bus. But first, some biography. I'll call him Novalis because that was the name he chose for his written works. The name was chosen because his ancestors from centuries before settled land and titled themselves De Novali, Latin for the newcomers, or one could say pioneers. And Novalis himself was a pioneer in the metaphysical sense. He was born in 1772. When he was just 28 years old, he was diagnosed with tuberculosis. One recent researcher has suggested it may have been cystic fibrosis. In any case, he died just before his 29th birthday. He was one of 11 children, not so uncommon in those days, born into a family of modest means with some aristocratic background. His family were pietists. This was Lutheranism with an emphasis on living a holy life, encouraged by devotional practices, which you might think would be an aspiration for all Christians, and maybe all of us, if we could just decide who or what to devote ourselves to. Pietism within the Protestant movement, unshackled from Roman Catholicism, emphasized Bible study, but also the notion of a universal priesthood. The concept was that everybody had responsibility for their own self-restraint and spiritual growth. It couldn't be dependent upon someone up at the front telling people what to do. It emphasized an approach of kindness rather than a judgmental attitude toward those who believed differently. In his teenage years, Novalis was given an education befitting the relatively new age of enlightenment. Reason and the intellect were emphasized in an approach to understanding both nature and God. He read Goethe and Shakespeare. He went on to university to study law, philosophy, and history. At the age of 19, he had a poem published in a German literary magazine. Consequently, his father, who managed the family salt mine, withdrew him from his university and booked him into another university, where it was thought he would focus more on studies of practical benefit. And it reminds me of when I ran away to Sydney as a teenager to be an actor or something. And my father couldn't see the point. He was an accountant, didn't add up as far as he was concerned. In any case, I eventually, for my own reasons, turned to complete my law degree. Anyway, after graduating from university, Navalis worked as an actuary to fulfil his worldly obligations, but he continued to read extensively. He expressed his thoughts through philosophy and his feelings through poetry. With a sense of duty, Navalis prepared himself for a senior position in the family salt mine. When he was 25, he commenced mining studies, covering physics, alchemy, chemistry, medicine, and mathematics. At that time, alchemy was gradually being supplanted by what we know as modern chemistry. But the combination of spiritual growth, esoteric philosophy, and laboratory chemistry was an appealing combination to young Navalis. Rather than detracting from his romantic and majestic view of the universe, he incorporated scientific knowledge into his philosophy and his fictional works. The word tragic has, sadly, I think, been overused to the point of cliche these days. When somebody's cat is run over, it's in the newspaper as a tragic incident. And I'm not saying that it's not sad or unfortunate, especially for the cat, but I think tragedy, comedy, and irony, as understood by the ancient Greek dramatists, is not commonly enough appreciated. That could be a talk for another day. In the case of Novalis, one is tempted to describe his early death as tragically premature. He had only published a fraction of his novels and poetry before his death. If he had lived a full life, he might have been another Goethe. Then again, in a profound sense, perhaps he had said all there is to say. But long after his death, he was primarily known for his romantic poetry. Romantic not just in the sense of expressing personal love, but romantic in the broadest sense, having a sensitive and deep appreciation of what is sacred in the universe, in the stars, in nature, and in ourselves. Let's enjoy some more music as we ponder. Number 21 in Chopin's Preludes. Before turning to some of his exquisite poetry, I must mention his romantic life in the personal sense, for it surely had a profound impact on Navalis and his poetry. Soon after graduating from university, Navalis met Sophie von Kühn and fell completely in love. He was 23, she was 12. They were different times. It was acceptable then for girls as young as 12 to be courted for the purpose of marriage at that time and place. They became secretly engaged, whatever that means. When the engagement became apparent, with Sophie still only 13, her parents consented to the match. The parents of Navalis, his father at least, frowned upon the engagement. And you might be thinking, well, at least somebody had the good sense to disapprove of a marriage to a 13-year-old. But that was not the reason for Mr. Herr von Hardenberg's disapproval. It was because he considered her family of insufficiently aristocratic background. Regardless of parental disapproval, one of the reasons Navalis took a senior position in the family salt mine operation was to ensure adequate income to be able to support his marriage to Sophie. Late in the year that they met, however, the 13-year-old Sophie developed a tumour on the liver. She was operated upon. She survived two more years and then died at the age of 15. Perhaps it was the sorrow of this experience and the loss of his brother to tuberculosis at about the same time that caused Novalis to write, quote, "Sometimes with the most intense pain, a paralysis of sensibility occurs. The soul disintegrates, hence the deadly frost, the free power of the mind, the shattering, ceaseless wit of this kind of despair. There is no inclination for anything anymore. The person is alone, like a baleful power, as one who has no connection with the rest of the world. One consumes oneself gradually, and in accordance with their own principle, they are misanthropic and misotheos. Misotheos, a distrust and dislike of God." He found the suffering of life could not be adequately expressed in ordinary language. Novalis wrote, "Poetry heals the wounds inflicted by reason." His grief motivated his most famous poetic work, Hymns to the Night. Enjoy the imagery in this passage. "But even more heavenly than the flashing stars are those infinite eyes which the night opens within us, and which see further even than the palest of those innumerable hosts." But life was not all Untergang und Finsternis, doom and gloom. Novalis was also in awe of the majesty of the universe. Quote, "To romanticize the world is to make us aware of the magic, mystery, and wonder of the world. It is to educate the senses to see the ordinary as extraordinary, the familiar as strange, the mundane as sacred, the finite as infinite." His dreamy philosophy has been described as magical idealism. He used the term magic with the aspiration that by a combination of the creative imagination and the will, one could dissolve the barrier between subject and object. One could overcome the illusion of separation in the world. Now, you may think of this romanticization as foolish. Or is the one who cynically manages life on a purely physical, transactional basis really the fool? Novalis explains, "The world must be romanticized. Only in that way will we rediscover its original sense. Romanticization is nothing less than a qualitative raising of the power of a thing. I romanticize something when I give the commonplace a higher meaning, the known, the dignity of the unknown, and the finite, the appearance of the infinite." Like many of mystical bent, Novalis poetically expressed the possibility of transcending this mundane life, like Plato's prisoners emerging in the sunlight. Quote, "We are close to waking when we dream that we are dreaming." Unquote. Those who have ears to hear, let them hear. Again, echoing Plato's imagery, he wrote, "The imagination places the world of the future either far above us or far below, in relation of metempsychosis to ourselves," as Christine read earlier. Despite the painful loss he had experienced, about 18 months after Sophie's death, Novalis became engaged again. He and his fiancée Julie did not get to marry, but they remained close until his death, some 2 years after they became engaged. Novalis was born about a century after the death of Spinoza, the great 17th century philosopher, and Novalis agreed with much of Spinoza's thinking. Novalis was attracted to the idea of the universe being unitary. He was attracted to the idea that by understanding the universe with reason, one could be assisted in achieving mystical insight into the unitary sum of it all. Novalis sought to convey the unity of all beings in a Zen-like epithet. Stat nicht ich, du. Instead of not I, you. And what was the point of philosophy? His was not a dry philosophy. It was a philosophy of yearning. Quote, philosophy is really nostalgia, the desire to be at home. Where are we really going? Always home. He was for reason. He was for art. He was for the spirit. As he said, knowledge is only one half. Faith is the other. His faith, ostensibly Christian, was bound up inextricably with his mystical sensibility. Again from Hymn to the Night, quote, I turn away from the light to the holy, inexpressible, mysterious night. Far away lies the world, sunk into a deep grave. Its place is waste and lonely. Across my heartstrings a low melancholy plays. I will fall in drops of dew and merge with the ashes. Distant memories, the wishes of youth, the dreams of childhood, the brief joys and vain hopes of a long life, all arise dressed in grey, like evening mist after sunset. In other lands, light has pitched its merry tents. And if it never returned to its children, who would await its dawning with the innocence of faith? He lived an orderly life, but experienced that which cannot be constrained by the rules of society. Quote, in a work of art, chaos must shimmer through the veil of order. His emphasis on oneness in this magnificent interconnected web of nature did not detract from a recognition of individual human agency in all this. Quote, life must not be a novel that is given to us, but one that is made by us. And yet, another quote, every individual is the center of a system of emanation. And perhaps the final words should be one of Novalis's briefest aphorisms. Humanity is a comic role.
We hope you've enjoyed this Expanding Horizons podcast. These podcasts are the intellectual property of the presenter. They can be used only with the express permission and appropriate acknowledgement of the presenter. This permission can be obtained by emailing admin@unitarianSA.org.au. Please feel free to leave a comment or visit us on Facebook or Twitter by searching SA Unitarians or by visiting our website at unitarianSA.org.au.